The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
To continue a little bit on the theme of last week, which was intentions, the role and importance of intention. Partly it's inspired by a visit I had on Sunday to San Quentin. I go there every year. I bring the Buddhist chaplains that I train, I bring them to San Quentin on a field trip. And we visit a violence prevention class and a meditation class, and sometimes we get a tour of the prison. And it's quite impactful, to meet these people. Quite unusual about this visit was that we were in a room full of probably a dozen prisoners, convicts, and we were about a dozen ourselves. And one of the prisoners was new to San Quentin. He'd been in other state prisons, been there for a month or two. And he said, "This is amazing. In my 5 years at this other prison, I saw a layperson maybe once. And to be in a room freely without any guards with 12 was kind of remarkable for him." And they were very forthright with us, maybe because as a violence prevention class, they had been kind of worked with their issues a lot. And they were quite forthcoming about why they were there, uncharacteristically so. Usually you don't talk about that much in prison, but they kind of went around the room and actually said what they were there for. It's quite impressive. And at one point, one of the instructors said that he had done an exercise with in one of the classes they had, where they had about 20 prisoners there, and had asked them, how long they'd been in prison, each one of them, and he added up the years of everyone in the 20 people there, and it was something like 223 years. And then he asked that they have this idea of the period of imminent danger, which is the little period of time when they're in danger of being violent, doing something that, a crime. And said, how when you did your crime that brought you into the prison, how long were you in that period of imminent danger? And I think the longest was, he mentioned, was something like 2 or 3 hours. Most of them were something like between 10 and 30 seconds. So they added up all those time, and they got something like 17 hours. And then they had one side of the blackboard, they had 223 years. And the other, they had 17 hours. And that apparently makes a big impression on the prisoners. And one of the things that makes an impression for us for them to study and be attentive to that period of imminent danger. What happens to them? What are the conditions that set themselves up so that they react impulsively or act in these periods when they're in danger, and how to prevent that from acting that way. And one of the things they said, they have a lot of little acronyms and sayings in the part of this violence prevention class. But one of the little sayings they have that came out of something a prisoner said some years ago was they said, they have this idea now that hurt people hurt and healed people heal. Hurt people hurt. So some idea that if you're hurt, if you're in pain, you're more likely to inflict pain. Not necessarily so, but that's often a condition for it. And if you're healed, you're more likely to pass on healing to others. And this goes somewhat along lines of in Buddhism, where the idea of intention is closely connected to the idea of karma. And karma is a teaching about the consequence, consequential effect of our intentional acts. That our intentional acts have a result. And that result can be immediate, it can be in a day, it can be in a year, it can be in the future, but there's a result. But that result is shaped by the quality of the intention. And one way that I've seen people kind of simplify the Buddhist teachings on karma, is saying like this. Whatever your actions are based on, you get more of that. So if your actions are based on kindness, you get more kindness. If your actions are based on hate, you get more hate. If your actions are based on pain, motivated by pain, reactively, you get more pain. Or if your actions are based on love, you get more love. If your actions are based on anger, you get more anger. You produce anger. If your actions are based on ill will, you get more ill will. If your actions are based on generosity, you produce more generosity. I'm sure you can kind of argue this a little bit and say, well, there's all kinds of exceptions, or this is too simplistic. But yes.
When you say get, do you mean receive or produce?
Both. Do you get, when I say get, do you mean receive or produce? You produce more. Whether you get it, receive it in yourself, or you create it in the world, it kind of all comes around. We can see it, I think, that acts of kindness, probably all of you have been in situations where you've seen acts of kindness being done, and it's inspired you to be kinder, or more generous, or do something. And then if you're kind, you're probably more likely to receive the recipient of other people's kindness. You're also a lot more likely to strengthen your own kindness, not necessarily so, but strengthen them. So in this violence prevention class, these are the kind of principles that these prisoners were learning. And one of the things they talked about was how important it is to, how necessary it is for them to sit in the fire, to forbear, to restrain, to hold back, not act impulsively, but learn to sit with their pain, sit with their hurt, sit with what's there, so that something else can happen besides their reactive reactions to the world. So they have an acronym, which they call Q-tip, which is quit taking it personally. And that this helps them on the yard, they say. And but also to not react, not act. It's been said that when actions that are motivated by healthy intentions are, the expression I read about it was front-loaded. Actions that are based on unskillful actions that can cause harm and are back-loaded. And what this means is that when you act on healthy or skillful or useful, kind, compassionate motivations, it often takes a thought and consideration. It takes becoming quiet. It takes a little bit of reflection or pausing or taking in the situation more fully. Sometimes it takes wrestling with oneself. It takes a lot of patience. And so up front, it takes some effort and work. But in the back end, afterwards, you don't have to do that much. But unskillful acts, lying to someone, stealing to someone from someone, yelling at someone in some angry way or whatever, those can, front end, sometimes are very quick to do. They come out so quickly and so easily. But the back end, afterwards, there's often a lot of time taken to make amends or deal with it or deal with what's feeling. So these prisoners, it takes 223 years, for some of them, for these, what happened so quickly. But we kind of, sometimes you lie to a friend, and you have to spend a long time kind of reclaiming, or not reclaiming, but regrowing the trust in the relationship. It takes a lot of work, but the lie came out quite quickly, or the mean expression. We can say it very quickly, and then the consequence can happen for much longer. Or if we're too casual sometimes, and not paying careful, mindful attention to what's really going on in a situation, and then we say something and do something we wish we didn't do, and then it's a lifetime of consequence because of it. And so in order to live skillfully, wisely, it takes sometimes some effort up front. And people don't like effort sometimes. There's plenty of people who'd rather do things easily, have it come out quickly and easily. And the kind of strange thing is that for the untrained heart, untrained mind, sometimes unskillful, swearing, yelling, stealing, lying, sometimes it's amazing how easily and quickly these things can come out. And I believe some of the reasons for that is that it's often reactive emotions. We react to situations rather than respond thoughtfully, mindfully, with consideration. And the reactions kind of, you know, are triggered quite quickly. And so how do we take into account, how do we work with the inner life, the inner conditions, so that we don't live reactively, but we live responsibly, responsively. And the first thing that's required is you have to want to. And that's a tall order, because some people would rather just live their life casually or make it easy for them. But to really want to change the inner life, the inner conditions, so that we can let the wisdom or let our love or compassion or our peace be in the forefront. And this is where the teachings on intention becomes very important, to really spend time looking at what our intentions are, the deepest intentions for our life, and really kind of, what can we do to feed that or fuel that or develop it? It was quite beautiful, these prisoners. Some of them, I've met them several years in a row, and some of them had this, they've been doing this work for a long time, and some of them had these beautiful smiles in their eyes, this beautiful peace and delight. It's just, you know, you're in a room with someone, you know, we were alone in a room with this guy who had shot someone, killed someone. And I felt so safe. But when he told his story, I don't think it would have felt safe most of his life around him. He was, for 25 years, he had been one of the kind of gang leaders in prison. And he just had made it his business to find who he can beat up. You know, really tough guy, an angry guy. And at some point he turned his life around. He turned it around. And he turned it around because he was in prison. And coincidentally, his brother ended up in the same prison and ended up in the same cell. His older brother. And his older brother was pacing in the cell one day, and he said to his brother, "I know you. We grew up together. There's something you want to tell me." And he said, "Yep. I want to apologize for you. Because when you were a kid, you know, a young teenager or something, 12 years old, your father died, and I left. And you were the only person, you know, you were left to be the man of the family. And with unprepared for it, and I want to apologize for abandoning you and leaving you and to your what you did." And then the brother said, "I'm going to die here in prison, but we don't have to die." And the expression "we don't have to die," "I'm going to die, but we don't have to die," meant that you don't have to die in here. If you don't die in prison, then we don't die. And that kind of turned this tough guy around. That got his attention. And then he turned his life. And now he's a, you know, beautiful man. But one of the things I talked about was getting out of prison before you're out. And a lot of that had to do with the intentions by which they lived in. You know, what they were trying to, kind of how they were trying to live their lives, and taking responsibility for how they live their lives. If they could take responsibility for their actions, their thoughts, their feelings, their intentions, then they could feel free, regardless of where they were. But if they didn't take that inner responsibility, then they weren't free. And some of these people we saw was quite something to see, that freedom. There was one man we met there who said every morning he gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning to meditate, because it's the only time in the monastery where it's quiet. And then at one point, one of the prisoners, in a very powerful way, said, I think someone asked, what would you like the world to know about San Quentin, about the prison? And he said, oh, what you should know is that San Quentin is kind of make-believe, because it's kind of a hybrid prison. It's really good here. The other state prisons, they don't have any programs like this. Or they had some, but the high school equivalency programs now have been cut out because of the budget problems. And so there's no possibility of getting a high school education through being in prison, and no rehabilitation going on. And it was quite something to hear them say, this is not really real here at San Quentin. And they were quite upset, some of these lifers, about there was a teens at risk program where they bring teens from at-risk communities into San Quentin to see what goes on there to frighten them, right? So you don't want to do this. And they said, these kids don't see the real prison here in San Quentin. It looks good here. They go out in the yard and they're playing baseball and basketball and everybody's schmoozing, and it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of compared to, they should see the other prisons. We can't show these kids what goes on in here, because they're going to be eaten up in the other prisons if they go there. It was kind of touching to hear these prisoners' concern for, they kept calling them kids. So back to this intention. A few minutes ago I used the expression, our deepest intention, and I use that a lot. You know, what's, you know, to spend time reflecting, what is your deepest intention? I think it's a very important question. But earlier this week, someone talked about her highest aspiration. And then I was echoing my mind, you know, I say deepest intention, she said highest aspiration. You know, is it deep or high? What is this? And I thought that the difference, maybe there's a difference, I don't know about for this woman who said it, but to aspire for something, it seems like it's work, it's out there, it's far away. But high is work, climbing the mountain. But deep is inside. Deep is more feeling that you relax and settle into something rather than work at it. So deep implies some, it's already here. Aspire sometimes implies in my vocabulary that it's out there. It's like a north star that you guide yourself by, perhaps, as opposed to a inner kind of motivation or guide that kind of comes from inside. And one of the things that I've seen is that intention has both aspects. Intention has an active aspect of something that we aspire to, that we consider and work to build. But also, I think what's been very important for me is the idea that our deepest aspiration or intention is not something that we have to construct or make, but it's something we discover by relaxing and settling into here. That there's almost like an innate impulse of beautiful intentions that want to come out if all the crusts on the outside, the defensiveness and the aggression on the outside, have a chance to settle down. Then there's something, a beautiful voice, a beautiful something inside that motivates us. It's kind of like what people are learning about empathy. That empathy is for many people, is almost like an innate capacity. It's an innate sense that we have. But it's not a sense that operates very well if we're frantic, running around being very busy or angry or preoccupied with our own hurt and pain. But if we can relax and be still enough, that organ that senses empathy can operate in that stillness and that openness. So that the empathy is there, kind of innately, given a chance to operate. So when I went to Zen Center, when I was practicing at Zen Center in San Francisco in the 1980s, I was a priest there, and I went to, during middle 80s, I went to Asia, to Southeast Asia, and practiced Vipassana, this practice that I'm teaching here. And one of the specialties of this practice here is that there's a lot of understanding of the inner workings of the mind, a lot of understanding the inner workings, the details of meditation, what happens in meditation, and the environment, the technology, and I don't know the word technology, the map of the inner experience, in a way that they don't have in Zen. And in fact, when I was in Asia, we talked a lot about what happened in our meditation experience. And the Zen Center was there for years, and no one ever talked about their meditation experience. And they talked about everything else about their life. It was almost like a taboo about talking about meditation experience. So at some point I was in a meeting of all these priests, and what kind of senior people at Zen Center, and I raised my hand and said, "It's kind of odd. You know, we're this meditation tradition. We sit and meditate a lot in Zazen, but we never talk about what happens in meditation. Why is that?" Well, I was met with silence. No one said anything, which I thought, you know, did I say something wrong? But afterwards, one of the senior priests came up to me, sided up next to me, and said, "Oh, Gil, let me tell you why. I don't know why you didn't want to say it in public, but came up privately and said, I'll tell you why. Because here at Zen Center, what we do is, the primary practice is clarifying or purifying our intention. And I thought that was beautiful. And the idea, the implication was that if you purify or clarify what your deepest intention is, then everything else lines up appropriately. Everything else finds its way from there. You don't have to kind of, what happens in meditation, what happens in your life, kind of follows a kind of a healthy direction, finds its own way, if you kind of find the deepest, clearest intention that you have. So a lot of the discussion at Zen Center with teachers had to do with understanding and clarifying intentionality, the sense of purpose which behind what motivated how you lived your life. So I spent a lot of time looking at my intentions and trying to understand them and to purify them, clarify what they are. And I've learned a few things I found very useful about it, about that process of exploring intention. One is, if you spend time looking, what is my deepest aspiration, wish for my life, or deepest intention in this situation I'm in here? Not the surface thing of what I want to, you know, but really, you know, what's the deeper purpose this is really about? If the intention is stated negatively, try to restate it positively. So, for example, if the intention is, I'd like to live without fear. That's a beautiful intention. But turn it around and say, if you lived without fear, if you had no fear, then what would you want for yourself? Oh, I'm allowed to think that? Oh, that's a whole different world then. If fear is not kind of the primary kind of thing that my life is about. Oh, if I didn't have any fear, then I'd like to love. And love is a very different, takes many different expression, different way of acting in the world than if you're acting or dealing with fear. And sometimes if you uncover the deeper intention that's behind the negative one, then you don't have to wait to get through the fear to begin loving more. You can sometimes do it directly. Some intentions, like the intention for safety, is, you know, kind of closely connected to fear. So if you could be safe, then what would be your intention? What would your wish be for yourself, or for, you know, for this life of yours? So to take your intention, see if you stayed negatively, see if you can turn it around positively. The other is to see if you're, listen to the intention you have and see if it's compensatory or reactive to something. So, my intention is to relax, to live a relaxed life. But perhaps that's only there because you're tense. So then you can do this act of imagination, say, well, if I really didn't have any tension, so that being relaxed was not the purpose, then how would I live? What would motivate me then? Or if it's reactive to something in the world, to look at that reaction and ask underneath, you know, if I wasn't reacting to this, or if this thing that I'm reacting to is not there, what would I really want then? So, for example, someone might be reacting to not having enough money. Some people are poor, lot of people are poor. And so they could be reacting to that and saying, well, if I'd like to have a lot of money, I'd like to have a house, I'd like to have financial security. It's certainly important to have, but does that represent your deepest intention? You know, are there things that are even deeper or more integral to who you are that aren't really dependent on poverty or wealth, poverty having money? And so I would suggest perhaps, you know, the intention to be financially secure, as important as it is, maybe it's a reaction to a previous condition. Are there intentions? Are there motivations we can base our life on which are not reactive to the conditions around us, but rather are more innate or more bubble up in and of themselves, rather than, you know, from an open heart, from a clear heart, from an open mind? And that's what I've discovered through my years of Buddhist practice, is the more still I get, the more there seems to be a beautiful intentionality, a beautiful sense of purpose that seems to just be there. That's much more important to me than a lot of the things that drive popular society. And to me, I cherish this. To me, it's something that feels deeply, deeply satisfying, because it's closely connected to a sense of peace, integrity, wholeness, authenticity. And I've learned, for me, I feel like I've discovered that by learning to sit and meditate. By sitting and being still and listening, that being still, being sitting in the middle of the fire, which, you know, there's been a lot of fire, just like these prisoners have to sit in their fire, sit in the fire of pain and reactivity and not react to it, not give into it, but let it sit there and shed itself, dissolve itself, resolve itself, all these things. Well, here's an interesting saying. You'll never solve your problems in meditation, but you'll dissolve them. Isn't that nice? What would you rather do? Resolve them or dissolve them? Anyway, both happen, but sit still. And I've seen over and over and over again that being still and being mindful allows some inner unfolding, inner processing, inner clarification to happen. That's very different than if I'm in charge trying to make it all figure out how it's supposed to be done. So willingness to sit and be. And then that sitting and being, the layers fall away. Layers fall away. And then the deepest places of intentionality, of purpose, can be there. So finally, I'd like to offer another word for intention, a kind of synonym, that perhaps is a wonderful meeting place of deepest intention and higher aspiration, since I kind of put those opposed to each other. And it's the word dedication. And so the question is, what is your life dedicated to? Is your life dedicated to anything? And if you get really quiet and still, if you spend a day, you know, walking in a park or walking on the beach or someplace in nature quiet, where a lot of your normal everyday concerns can fall away, and you ask your question, you know, what is my life dedicated to? What would I like it to be dedicated to? In 20 years, well, how would I like to look back at these next 20 years? And realize this is what my life was about. This is what I accomplished, or a sense of purpose that I had. So I found it very beneficial to spend a lot of time clarifying, purifying intention. And I've spent years doing that. Certain intentions I had, I remember one very important one, I spent a whole year living with that idea and intention, looking at it, refining it, looking at all the ego and fear that was connected to it. It was not a quick and easy thing to sit and discover your intention, but it's really a beautiful thing to uncover. So those are my thoughts this morning, and we have about 10 minutes. If some of you would like to ask questions or make comments, or yes, please, Linda. If we have a
My daughter is in college, and she has a part-time job at Starbucks. And in talking to the people she works with, she discovered recently that one of them had just been released from jail. And she was having a conversation with him about how that happened. And he said that he had been in jail several times, and that that was really the only way he knew to be safe. He had a roof over his head. He had food. And he doesn't seem to know how to make things work when he's not in jail. So he sort of deliberately takes actions that will end him in jail. And I found it very poignant. But it seems as if that's his intention, is to get back in jail. So it's very interesting.
There are such people, and for sure. And it makes me think about some of these prisoners yesterday were quite concerned that how little rehabilitation there is in the state of California to prepare people better to go out and, you know, and live better lives. They're quite lucky in San Quentin. A number of them had started taking college classes, had graduated from college. So they're prepared better if they ever get released. But if you don't get prepared, sometimes people are not prepared. They didn't get prepared growing up. And prisons, you know, is not doing it in jail either. Also strikes me that perhaps he's just been to county jail. You know, I think one of the first people who spoke to us yesterday, on Friday, was a relatively young man who was very forthcoming about his crime and what he did, and what it was like to come into prison as a young man, I think he was 19, and to be raped, and raped, and raped. So, you know, maybe he's lucky. Maybe he hasn't seen the full prison system yet.
I was contemplating what you were saying about, you know, finding dedication. What you're dedicated to and what you want to be 20 years from now when you look back. And then afterwards you went on and said, I spent a year looking at my intention. And I was thinking, that was a strange juxtaposition there. I was thinking, it sounds to me like the only dedication that makes sense right now is to dedicate yourself to finding out what your dedication is. It comes kind of this loop that never ends, in a sense. Just wonder if you have any thoughts on what I'm saying, or even make sense what I'm saying.
It makes sense. I think perhaps it's useful to think about our lives are multifaceted or multi-layered. So my intention right now is to try to give a response that's helpful for you. So that's this moment here. The then I could also kind of step back and say my intention is to, my overall intention of my life is to live a life that's of service, that tries to help make a difference in this world of ours. And that was the one that I spent a year thinking about when I was a young man. And that was worth, I didn't trust that intention. So I felt like I really need to spend time looking at it. And after that year, I decided it was okay to follow through on the intention to be of service. But I didn't trust it. So then, since then, the course has been set. I don't have to review it much anymore. I did review it a few years ago. When I turned 50, I went backpacking alone for 5 days, where I reviewed it. Reviewed all this. What's my life about? Where have I come from? Where am I going? What do I want to do with it? And I said, it actually hasn't changed. That, you know, that's still what I want to do. That's what I want to do. When I was a young man? Oh, I thought, why didn't I trust my intention to want to be of service, to help alleviate suffering in the world? Was I'd seen too many people who had a lot of ego, a lot of self-identity, and a lot of ulterior motives behind being a helper, and helping people. And so I didn't trust myself, since I'd seen it around me. So I wanted to make sure that it was okay, and I worked through that, worked through if I had layers of intentions like that. So I spent a lot of time just kind of going through and thinking about this. And I had a lot of time. I was in a monastery. So I had a lot of time to look at it. So I don't know if that was responded to your answer, but there's so many different kinds of intentions operating all the time. So some questions, you know, you can answer right away. It's very clear what you want. Some issues you want to spend time reflecting on. Some people who want to make big changes in their life sometimes will go on retreats, meditation retreats, go off like for 10 days. And sometimes they'll say at the beginning of the retreat, I'm here because I want to decide what career to go on, whether I'm going to marry this person, or should I, you know, what should I do next and change jobs or something. And I'll tell them, that's great. But try not to think about it until the last day or two of the retreat. And the reason for that is that if they can put aside those concerns, those thoughts, for 8 days and just meditate on the retreat, they'll get settled, they'll get open, they'll get the mind will kind of purified or clarified. And then on the 8th day, 9th day, 10th day, they'll have a whole different capacity and reference point to which to look at what they want that they didn't at the beginning of the retreat.
So does that usually help them?
More often than not, yes. I can't say all the time, but more often than not, people often get some clarity.
Sitting in the fire and not reacting to the hindrances that come up or the defilements that come up, and trying to find skillful ways of not being overwhelmed or not being trapped or hooked by them. Could you speak to that? The sitting in the fire is, you know, every one of us wants to be a brave soldier, but it's another thing when you're really sitting in the fire.
Well, there's, what comes to my mind hearing that is that there are a lot of different ways of doing it, and a lot of different ways of doing, ways of not reacting, sitting in the fire. It's very abstract what you said, so the answers might be very much different if it was very specific issues, you know, different situations. But two things come to mind. One is learn to sit still. Learn what it's like to not give in. And so meditation practice is very useful for that because, you know, you've committed yourself for 45 minutes or however long not to move. You know, and so all kinds of feelings, reactions, thoughts come up, but you don't give in to them. You don't go with them. And over again, you let go of the impulse to follow a thought, follow an emotion, follow a reaction. And that's a very powerful training, because then once you've learned that muscle, felt that muscle of not giving in, that might be really important outside of meditation when you feel this come up. The other thing that occurs to me is tell someone else what you're struggling with. Share it with someone, and so you're not alone with it. And someone else, you're accountable to someone else. You're someone else supportive of you. Someone else can check in with you, so that sometimes including other people in your own process gives strength to your own wisdom to operate.
Thank you. I think both of those things, especially the first one about transferring that skill from in the sitting practice to just being aware of when it's happening in your daily life, is another skill all on its own, is bringing it there. But also speaking to a good friend about it, I think, is... Thanks.
Did the prisoners in the group talk about whether other prisoners noticed any changes in them, and if so, how the other prisoners responded?
Well, I asked how people got into the program, because it's all volunteer, the program. And some of them said it's because they got in because they saw how some other prisoners that they knew had changed. There was one man there who said that very specifically, you know, this guy, you know, I'd known him for many years in prison. He was like a terrible, terrible guy, tough guy, and I couldn't believe how much he changed. So then he invited me to the program, so then... You know, so by example, that's one way. That was the only answer we were given by example, since it's voluntary.
I was wondering if there's kind of the opposite kind of reaction, where I would imagine the prison system kind of works by fear, and so if somebody kind of stops projecting a fearful presence, that would then be viewed as weakness by other prisoners?
Maybe. But, I think these people have been in prison, most of them have been in prison for a long time, and they knew how to negotiate their way. They knew how to be, where to stand, where to go. They had their little groups that, they hung out with. And San Quentin, people there tend to be in their best behavior because you're only there. San Quentin's a really good place to be, mostly, unless you're death row. But it's a mostly a good place to be. So there's a lot of programs, and so people don't want to upset the status quo there. And so they tend to be these days, compared to the old days. Prisoners who've been there for a long time said, 11, 12 years ago was a bloodbath here. But now it's completely changed. And the prison system moved people around so that it's more motivated people at San Quentin. But it was quite touching. So we had an informal time. We kind of just milled around the classroom talking, and I talked to two prisoners, and they were clearly good friends. And they were kind of, they touch each other's shoulder, and there's also warmth between them. One of them was white, and one was black. And they started telling me. I started asking them what it was like, outside of the class, and they said, outside of the class, we can't really relate much to each other. I said, because we're segregated. The dining room, where it's the blacks here and the whites here and the Hispanics here, and I said, what would happen if you, the white guy, walked over to the black guy's side of the room to talk to your friend? And he said, it's okay. I could go over there and tell him I'd like to talk to you later, or what happened, earlier in the day, and have a very brief conversation. But anything longer than that, I can't do that. There's boundaries I can't cross. In fact, I crossed them once. I was playing chess with a black man, and my homeboys got up and stood in a circle around the chess game, made it clear that this can't continue. And so I say that in response it was quite painful to hear this, but there's some really strong rules that people live by there, and they know the rules. And so the prison guards. We were in the middle of our class, and suddenly this guard kind of bursts through the door and says, "Is so-and-so here?" No answer. And he said, "Okay, everybody back to your cells." Because, someone was unaccounted for. But it was kind of relaxed so that we didn't break up right away. And then there was this beautiful Native American man who was clear from the very beginning that there was something special about him. There was this presence, there was this kind of joy, this presence, this kind of sensitivity. And he was like, you could see he was taking us all in this beautiful way, like really sensing us in his silence. And he was in his late 50s. He had been in prison since he was 19. And sweet man, beautiful man. And he had made a Native American flute while he was in prison. And he wanted to play it for us. So before breaking up to go back to the cells, they were going to take the time to let him play the flute. And then there was a little bit more processing, and then the word came back that the man had been found, that we could stay, we could keep doing our class. Then he played his flute later. It was really touching, his Native American flute song. It was such a beautiful experience over there. It was very painful. It was kind of a very interesting juxtaposition of tremendous amount of suffering on many different fronts. And And this beauty and freedom. Oh, something that just occurred to me. You know, so the program I went to saw was Jacques Verdun's program, right? So he came here in December, right? So some of you heard him speak. Brought some of his ex-convicts to talk. Beautiful program they have. Okay, so thank you. And I hope these words about intention are meaningful for you and help you reflect a little more deeply.